is on arms control. It's been a long fight, but came out well in the end. We've long hoped that he would visit us and discuss arms control. He is, as all of you know, a lawyer and public servant, a partner of Clifford and Warnke. He was chief U.S. arms negotiator, arms control negotiator, and director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in the Carter administration. He's a graduate of Yale and Columbia Law School, had numerous honorary degrees, Grinnell, Amherst, George Washington U, and other places. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs in the Johnson administration. He's been a member of the Disciplinary Board of the District of Columbia Bar, also its Board of Governors. He served on the boards of both Columbia University and Georgetown University and the Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He's been a member of the Advisory Committee to the Yale University Growth Center, Economic Growth Center. He served in World War II from as lieutenant from 1942 to 46. So we're delighted that the principal negotiator of the SALT II treaties and earlier involved in other aspects in the Johnson administration is joining the group of people to whom we've turned for counsel and wisdom on arms control.
Thank you very much.
I thought this morning I'd like to talk briefly about three areas of arms control that are currently the hot areas. One of them is the completion of a strategic arms reduction treaty, the so-called START talks. The second is a stand down in the military confrontation in Europe. It goes by the delightful acronym of CAFE, Conventional Armed Forces in Europe. And then finally, the question of chemical weapons. I'll deal with them in accordance with my sense of priority. Now, to me, the greatest threat that the world has ever faced is the threat of nuclear war. Accordingly, I think that we have to make sure that we don't get confused about what the relative importance of all of these negotiations is. Now, granted, we haven't had nuclear weapons used for more than 40 years. And during that period of time, there have been a number of, you know, of conventional wars. But the consequences of a nuclear war are so cataclysmic that I think we have to recognize that the fundamental objective is to reduce the risk of a nuclear war to the vanishing point. Now, I was concerned at the beginning of the Bush administration about some indications that they did not sense that same urgency that I feel. There were some suggestions that perhaps conventional weapons would take priority, and that we really couldn't afford to reduce our nuclear weapons until we had reached a state of conventional arms parity with the Warsaw Pact. Now, there really is no reason why we can't conduct those negotiations concurrently. Certainly, we aren't so devoid of negotiating talent that we can only undertake one negotiation at one time. There are plenty of experienced negotiators, and I think that both ought to proceed, and ought to proceed with the maximum rapidity. There is, in my opinion, no linkage between the two. The fact is that strategic nuclear weapons, let's put aside tactical battlefield nuclear weapons for the time being, but the fact is that strategic range nuclear weapons are not fungible with conventional military strength. Harry Truman said many years ago that he can't conceive of anybody starting a nuclear war. And I can't conceive of it ever being in our interest or in the interest of our European allies to convert a conventional war into a strategic exchange. So accordingly, we don't have to be concerned about cutting back on our strategic nuclear forces while we still are trying to negotiate conventional parity with the Warsaw Pact. And I point out that even after the completion and implementation of a START treaty, we would still have about 8,000 strategic nuclear weapons. And there aren't that number of worthwhile targets in the Soviet Union or the other Warsaw-Pact countries. So we aren't talking really about a massive cut in nuclear forces. At the present point, both we and the Soviet Union have got about 12,000 strategic nuclear weapons. We have a few more, they have a few less. Now, START has been pictured as a 50% cut, but that's only partly true. It's 50% when you're dealing with ballistic missile warheads. But there are liberal counting rules when it comes to weapons on strategic bombers. For example, we would count, under our proposal, a strategic bomber as having 10 air-launched cruise missiles. The fact is that they might carry as many as 20. Now similarly, a strategic bomber with nothing but short-range missiles and gravity bombs counts as one warhead, no matter how many warheads, in fact, it carries. So this is not a nuclear disarmament proposal. It's an effort to create greater strategic stability. And strategic stability doesn't necessarily depend on numbers. I sometimes give the illustration that supposing that both sides cut their forces, so they only had 100 ICBMs each. We had 100 silo-based ICBMs. It'd be a massive arms control feat. It'd be very, very substantial nuclear disarmament. But the result could be catastrophic, because if each of those missiles had 10 warheads, it would mean that an attacker could direct 1,000 warheads against 100 targets. Each side would have a clear first strike capability. And the only question at a time of real crisis would be which side would panic first. Because each side would recognize that by striking first, they could eliminate any retaliatory strike. So you have to be very careful about the way in which you cut nuclear weapons. Now, what the START proposals do is to try and create a situation in which you've got a better target-to-warhead ratio. What you would have is 6,000 strategic nuclear delivery vehicles. Those are the launchers of ICBMs, the launching tubes on the ballistic missile submarines, and of course, things like cruise missiles. Now, we don't have to worry much about the cruise missiles other than sea-launched cruise missiles. We've worked out counting rules, as I pointed out, with regard to the air-launched cruise missiles. The ground-launched cruise missiles are barred under the INF treaty. So the real problem there is how you count, how you monitor, how you verify the sea-launched cruise missiles. But there'd be 6,000 strategic nuclear delivery systems. There'd be, 1,600 strategic nuclear delivery systems with 6,000 warheads. And only 4,900 of those warheads could be on ballistic missiles. Now that would very substantially cut back on the so-called throw weight of the Soviet forces. We've been very concerned about their massive ICBMs, the SS-18s, which are much larger than anything that we have. And they do in fact have 10 warheads each. Now it's been agreed that they would cut that force from 308 SS-18s to 154. I think it's a very good idea. One of the reasons I think it's a good idea is we tried to get that back in March of 1977. At the beginning of the Carter administration, what we proposed to the Soviet Union was basically to kind of leapfrog SALT II and get on to more substantial reductions. At that particular point, they were not willing to do it. One of the reasons, I think, was basically bureaucratic inertia. I know that the Deputy Foreign Minister, Mr. Konyenko, rode with me out of the airport after our unsuccessful talks in Moscow. And he said, what you have to realize is that Comrade Brezhnev spilt a lot of political blood at Vladivostok. That was the meeting he had in 1974 with President Ford. And that was the meeting at which he agreed for the first time that the United States and the Soviet Union would have equal numbers after a reduction agreement. Prior to that time, they had insisted on being compensated for the fact that the French and British had nuclear weapons and that they were on our side. But what Konyenko pointed out was that Mr. Brezhnev, as a political necessity, needed his Vladivostok treaty. So what we did is to give him the cosmetics of Vladivostok, which were a total of 2,400 delivery systems, of which only 1,320 could be MIRV'd missile launchers. But we managed to get them to agree that that 2,400 figure would be in effect only for a year, and at the end of that year it'd come down to 2,250. And that the 1,320 would include only 1,200 ballistic missiles, the balance being strategic bombers with the air-launched cruise missiles that I've described. But now, of course, they are prepared to go much further. I think it would be a good agreement. I think that it would increase strategic stability. It would reduce the risk of nuclear war. It would eliminate, or should eliminate, our concern about the vulnerability of our own retaliatory force by cutting back on both the number of Soviet warheads and on the particularly accurate ones. Now, what's holding up START at the present time? There are essentially three problems that remain. One of them is the question of mobile missiles. Our position has been that we wanted a ban on mobile land-based ICBMs. That, however, cannot now be a serious position because the administration is asking for funds for not one but two mobile ICBMs. A rail basing system for the MX, a land mobile for the single warhead Midgetman. And it has now been indicated that we will drop that particular suggestion of a prohibition on mobile ICBMs. The second problem is sea-launched cruise missiles, a hard arms control item because of the relatively small size and the fact that they can be carried on any surface ship or any submarine. Now, at the Wyoming talks, Foreign Minister Shevardnadze said that they would put aside the question of cruise missiles. I think that's a good idea. It doesn't have to be handled along with the rest of the START Treaty. We have a lead at the present point, and therefore we have enough time to try and negotiate some kind of effective control. An effective control, in my opinion, would be something that's been proposed by Paul Nitzer, who was the chief arms control advisor during the Reagan years. And what he has suggested is that we eliminate all naval nuclear weapons, except for the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which is basically the heart of our retaliatory deterrent. Now, verifying zero is a lot easier than verifying any kind of a number. If you said, okay, we'll have something like 500 nuclear-tipped sea-launched cruise missiles each, you'd never be sure whether or not there were 500 or perhaps a couple of thousand. But verifying zero is a much, much easier task, particularly when it's zero with regard to a nuclear weapon. If you had a ban on any nuclear-tipped sea-launched cruise missiles, then all you'd have to do is find one to demonstrate a violation of the treaty. And there are certain conditions, of course, with regard to the controls and so forth of nuclear weapons. So we have quite a good deal of confidence that we could verify a zero ban. Would it be good for us? I think it'd be very good for us. The irony is that sea-launched cruise missiles are much more of a threat to us than they are to the Soviet Union. We have those two magnificent coasts that give us a lot of geostrategic advantages, particularly when it comes to ballistic missile submarines. We have very ready access to the sea. But in addition to that, of course, we have a lot of very valuable targets that are on or near the coast. and would be much more exposed to sea-launched cruise missiles than would Soviet targets, because they are relatively landlocked. So those two problems can, in my opinion, be handled. The third problem is the insistence that we've made up to this point on having a free hand when it comes to strategic defense. President Reagan, as you know, was captivated by the idea of some sort of a perfect screen that would render nuclear missiles impotent and obsolete. And therefore, he was unwilling to negotiate any sort of restrictions. At the same time, we can't expect the Soviet Union to make massive cuts in its offensive force if we have a free hand to go ahead with the territorial defense. We faced that problem ourselves back in the late 1960s when I was in the Johnson administration. The Soviet Union was proceeding with a territorial ABM defense. And we recognized that if, in fact, they deployed that sort of defense, we would have absolutely no option except to try and overwhelm the defense. And that therefore, instead of cutting our offensive weapons, we would have significantly to increase them to be sure that we had preserved our retaliatory deterrent and that they knew that any first strike on their part would mean their devastation. Now, what the Soviet Union has been concerned about is exactly that, that if they cut their offensive force, it makes it easier for us to deploy a defense. And the worry has been, as our worry was back in the 1960s, that if you have a territorial defense, you might be tempted to strike first and then figure that the very substantially reduced retaliatory force is something that your ballistic missile defense might be able to soak up. Now, that's what's been holding up the START fleet. I think it's beginning to be clear that we are now backing away from our obsession with strategic defense, that we recognize that the technology just is not available, and that we can greatly reduce the risk by getting cuts in offensive forces, and those cuts in offensive forces will not take place if, in fact, we try and deploy a defense that can be overwhelmed. Since it can be overwhelmed, it will be overwhelmed. For one thing, rather than cutting the SS-18 force, what they could do is add very substantially to the warhead loading. As I've said, they have 10 warheads each. They could readily, we figured back in the early, in the 1970s, they could readily increase that to 30 warheads each. Now, if they did that, you would be adding something like 6,000 warheads. So that's the real problem. Now, I think, as I say, that both sides are now less concerned about strategic defense. We're less enthusiastic about it. I think the president's dream left town with him. And they are less scared about it. One of the reasons they're less scared is that their own physicists have been telling them that it is technologically infeasible with any present known technology. And in particular, Mr. Sakharov, when he returned from exile in Gorky, has been preaching the doctrine that if the Americans want to go ahead and spend a couple of $100 billion on something that won't work, let's let them do it. It's better than spending it on something dangerous. So that I think that the president probably is not unduly optimistic when he says that he believes that a START treaty could be achieved by the time of his summit next year. The summit is scheduled for late spring or early summer, and I think it's realistic given the amount of work that has already been done on the problem. I would certainly hope that that is the case, and then we could move on to START 2. You have to recognize, in my opinion, that the arms control process has to be a continuing process. You're never going to get the ideal treaty in one step. What you have to do is get a good treaty, something that does, in fact, lessen the risk of nuclear war, and then try and work on a better one. Assault 2, I think, should focus on eliminating the MIRV'd multiple warhead ballistic missiles. If you got down to one warhead each, as in our proposed Midget Man, as in their SS-25 mobile missile, then there is absolutely no chance of a first strike, because you would have to use a number of missiles to have any chance of destroying one missile on the other side. And this, it seems to me, is the objective that ought to be sought. Now, at the same time, we ought to continue to go ahead with the conventional arms force reduction talks. Fortunately, we've got a head start. Back last December in his United Nations speech, Mr. Gorbachev announced a unilateral initiative that had meant a very substantial cutback in the surprise attack capability of the Warsaw Pact forces. He announced that he was going to pull out something like 6 tank divisions. And not only that, he'd eliminate 5,000 tanks from the Central European front. We'd still leave them with a massive number of tanks. But it is a move that probably is as good as we could have expected in the first stage of a negotiated treaty. Now, what President Bush has now proposed is that the cuts be made in a fashion that would bring the Warsaw Pact forces, particularly as far as personnel, tanks, armed personnel carriers, mobile artillery, down to something like 30% less. I'm sorry, to something we would cut, for example, some 30,000 troops and ask them to match that, which would mean they'd have to cut something like 300,000 troops. It'd be a very, very substantial decrease in the surprise attack offensive capability of the Warsaw Pact forces. Part of Mr. Gorbachev's unilateral initiative is also to eliminate the bridge crossing capability of the maneuver forces. Again, something that would tend to put an end to NATO's worst nightmare. Our concern has always been that the Soviet Union with the Warsaw Pact forces might strike first, capture a certain amount of territory, and then face us with the question as to whether we're going to escalate and bring about World War III. So this is, I think, a promising start. We ought to go much further than that. I'm much taken with the proposal that has been advanced by the former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Andrew Goodpatch. What he has said is, okay, this kind of a cut is fine. It saves the Soviet Union a bundle of rubles. It doesn't save us much, because we cut back from something like 305 to 275,000 troops with associated equipment. Not much of a budgetary savings. So what he says is, why not think about a 50% cut from the present NATO level? And have the Soviet Union match that. Again, a very substantial improvement as far as the military confrontation in Europe is concerned, and something that does yield the sort of budgetary savings for which we are so desperately looking. I'm optimistic that something can be done. At one point last spring, Jean and I were in England, and at that point, the Thatcher government was pushing very hard to get NATO to go ahead with the so-called modernization of its short-range nuclear forces. It threatened to be a real issue, both as far as the bilateral negotiation is concerned and in terms of our relations with the West Germans, who are very concerned about having additional, perhaps quite vulnerable, quite provocative nuclear targets on German territory. They have been concerned because of the fact that the reductions now leave nuclear weapons in Europe that probably can't get outside of Germany. If used, they would blow up on German soil. So this is an issue which fortunately now has been set aside, and I think it will facilitate the conventional force negotiations. Then finally, briefly, the question of chemical weapons. President Bush, during the campaign, said he wanted to be remembered as the president who had eliminated the scourge of chemical weapons. And he obviously is interested in this. It was the theme of his recent UN speech, in which he again repeated that phrase. And it is worthwhile. But we ought to recognize that chemical weapons are primarily a third world problem. They are not a major problem as far as the bilateral negotiations between the United States and the Soviet Union are concerned. We have many more efficient ways of demolishing one another than by old-fashioned World War I chemical warfare. But it is a very serious problem as far as the third world is concerned. Chemical weapons have sometimes been referred to as the poor man's atomic bomb. It's a weapon of mass destruction that's easily achieved and unfortunately can be used. We've seen that recently as far as the Iran-Iraq war is concerned. And Iraq apparently also used chemical weapons against their own Kurdish minority. We've been concerned about German supplied technology that might give Colonel Gaddafi in Libya a chemical weapons capability. So we ought to push on that front. But we ought to recognize that it's not primarily a bilateral issue. What we ought to do is to try and beef up the Geneva Convention of 1925 by making it illegal not only to use chemical weapons, but to make them and to maintain them. The Geneva Convention only bans use. It does not ban production or maintenance. Now, could it be verified? Probably not entirely. But it's not like nuclear weapons. The only deterrent against the use of nuclear weapons is the possession of nuclear weapons. You don't need chemical weapons to deter the use of chemical weapons. As a matter of fact, if we were to try and enforce a chemical weapons ban, we certainly wouldn't do it by unleashing poison gas on the population of the offending state. We'd use a far more surgical means. So we don't have to worry about 100% verification. What we ought to worry about is seeing to it that the moral pressure of the world community is brought to bear against anybody who wants to get into the chemical weapons business. I think that that can be achieved. I believe that the quite intrusive verification measures that we in the Soviet Union are prepared to accept handle whatever the residual bilateral fear is. But as they say, the real question is, how do we see to it that chemical weapons are not used as they have been by Iraq, as they were by Egypt in the Yemen war back a couple of decades ago, and that might be used, of course, in trouble areas. In the meantime, I think we ought to try and take advantage of the opportunities that now exist. There is, of course, speculation as to whether or not Mr. Gorbachev can last. It seems to me that even if he is replaced, it won't be because of his foreign policy or because of his defense policy. Those have been successes. For the first time, the Soviet Union has a world leader, somebody who has international appeal. And it doesn't seem to me that his successor would be apt to emulate his economic failures and perhaps to intensify them by spending more money on defense and to scrap his foreign policy successes. And in any event, we now have the opportunity to see to it that major progress is made on these three areas, perhaps on many others as well. And rather than speculating about how long he may last, let's take advantage of his presence. I think, Ken, that's all I want to say at this point.
We're delighted that Gene Warnicki is with us, and if she at any point wants to ask her husband any questions, why that's not foreclosed.
The only question she asks is, why don't you shut up?
Who would like to ask the first question? Yes, General Disson.
It's obvious, of course, that both the Soviets and us would gain materially by reducing the cost and investment in nuclear weapons. But because of their extremely powerful deterrent effects, do you look forward sometime to doing away with nuclear weapons entirely? I gather from your remarks that you do not.
No, I think that the idea of a nuclear-free world is an idea whose time has not come. And it won't come during my lifetime, and I'm afraid not the lifetime of any of us in this room. See, we don't even know how many countries presently have nuclear weapons. We have deep suspicions, but we aren't really sure. And even if we in the Soviet Union could be absolutely confident that each of us had eliminated all of our nuclear weapons, you wouldn't want to look around someday and find that Colonel Gaddafi was king of the nuclear hill. And we don't have the kind of a world regime at the present point that would permit us to have any degree of confidence that some nation state had not become a nuclear power. So that the real objective ought to be to end the risk of nuclear war. And that does not, in my opinion, require eliminating all nuclear weapons.
But would the reverse be true, that by retaining a certain amount of nuclear weapons that you thereby help preserve the peace or, as you say, reduce the risk of nuclear attack?
There certainly is a certain amount of what's been referred to as existential deterrence in just the fact that nuclear weapons exist. I think that certainly as far as the superpower relationship is concerned, that each side is chastened by the possession of nuclear weapons on both sides and is less apt to do something drastically bad. It is not proven, though, that nuclear weapons in our possession, the Soviets' possession, anybody else's possession, has prevented regional conflict. I think it's basically a question of whether or not the nuclear deterrent is an extended nuclear deterrent that prevents Warsaw Pact conventional attack. And I don't really think that strategic forces serve that role. You make a different argument when it comes to tactical battlefield nuclear weapons. I say because of the fact that they blow up in friendly territory. And the Soviet Union always has the option of calling off the invasion, going back home, and there's a home to go back to.
John Reddick and Reed Johnson, you've organized the most concentrated study group we have, a research group on arms control and security. Do either of you want to ask a question? You really could have organized the same meeting.
I've got a perceptual question, and that is, would you care to speculate how the third world threshold countries, by that I mean the Argentinas, Brazils, the Indias, the Pakistans, how they perceive our progress and that of the Soviet Union? Are they impressed by what we've accomplished? Do they see anything in what we are accomplishing that would suggest to them that maybe they should exercise restraint?
I think that they probably recognize that if we in the Soviet Union do make major strides toward reducing our strategic arsenals, and if, for example, we completed a comprehensive test ban, that the power of world opinion would be masked against anybody that looked as though they were getting into the nuclear weapons business. I think it would tend to drive their programs underground. But it's awfully hard to speculate because you don't know what the reasons are them acquiring nuclear weapons. Now, you can figure out in the case of Pakistan, the former head, Mr. Bhutto, when the Indians blew up an atomic device back in 1974, said that the Pakistanis would eat grass if necessary to get a nuclear weapon. And there's reason to feel that they've probably eaten enough grass. But Argentina and Brazil, it is awfully difficult for me to see what the motivation is. I mean, neither one of them is faced with an external threat. And being a nuclear power isn't going to solve their economic mess at home. So I don't really see what the reasons are. and I suspect that they would back off if, in fact, they felt that the United States and the Soviet Union were making so much progress as to make atomic weapons a dirty word. But it really depends upon the regional situation. I have no doubt that Israel has a small nuclear stockpile. Our evidence has indicated that for many years. And I doubt that they could be talked out of it.
And may I follow up?
Okay.
The effort to extend the limited test ban that's going on within the United Nations structure into a comprehensive test ban, do you see that having any velocity?
Probably not at the present time. During the Reagan administration, the U.S. position was that as long as we needed nuclear weapons for deterrence, we would have to continue to test. And the argument still is made that you have to test in order to be sure of the reliability of the stockpile. So I don't see that changing. And of course, the original signatories of the Limited Test Ban Treaty have got a veto power. And I just don't think that there's any question that we would exercise that veto under the present administration.
Reed, do you have questions?
I just wonder if you, Mr. Warnke, would like to comment on the element of increased stability that seems to be resulting from conflict among Eastern European countries, at least perceived conflict as the Soviets change direction and the Eastern European countries are sort of following a spectrum of change. This seems to me to have some consequences in terms of the potential for conventional conflict and hence the possibility of nuclear war. Wonder what your feelings on this are.
Can you hear any of the questions out there?
Yeah, good.
I would have to say I do not share Deputy Secretary of State Eagleburger's concern about the change in the status quo. Now, what he has said is that the Cold War basically meant a period of quite stable relations among the military powers. But now, I don't really think that we can look back with nostalgia on a situation in which we've sacrificed the freedom, the autonomy of the Eastern European nations in order to buy perhaps a certain degree of comfort in the status quo. It does seem to me that it's an unnatural situation, and I think the question is, how can we help the Soviets let go? I mean, these are countries that have existed, most of them, in fairly stable form in the past. They can look back. Hungary can look back. Czechoslovakia can look back. Even Poland can look back at a time at which they did have autonomy and managed to have reasonable internal stability. Now, as far as the Baltic states are concerned, their world history as autonomous states is a much briefer one, and nobody's quite sure. But I think that we can look forward to a situation in which, if the superpower relationship continues to improve, we can help the Soviet Union let go. And they'll feel free to do it. I think one of the reasons for the change is that nobody in their right mind really figures that the raving hordes of NATO are going to come pouring over the border to try and conquer Moscow. So that external threat basically it's a shibboleth. It isn't really there. They don't have an external threat. They don't need that buffer zone. Now, one thing that might change that, of course, is the German problem. I think that the Soviet Union is still very concerned about united Germany, and that ought to be fairly far down on the list of developments to take place.
Next question. Howard Cromwell.
I wanted to ask you if the winds that I read about indicate that the Warsaw Pact are anxious to become a part of the European community, and we no longer have the rivalry between NATO and the Warsaw Pact economically. Recently, the European community has offered to give millions of dollars more to Poland than what Bush had indicated. Would this, in turn, if this ever happens, and they become all one community, the Soviets and Hungary and so on, will this be the key to also arm reduction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if in the kind of a world that you're picturing, what would you need forces for, except for third world problems? You know, you'd still have an occasion in which American interests required some military force in some part of the world. But the big part of the budget is now being spent in this confrontation between East and West.
Sure.
And I do think that the European community is going to exercise a magnetic attraction to the Eastern Europeans. I suppose the next step would be the unaligned countries coming, Austria, for example, becoming part of an integrated Western Europe. And if Austria goes in, will Hungary be far behind? So I do think that there is going to be quite a dramatic shift. When we were in England, somebody told me a story about the pretender, the Austrian-Hungary throne, and somebody pointed out there was going to be a soccer match. And I asked him, are you going to go to the Austria-Hungary soccer match? And he says, yeah, who will we play?
Professor Fernbach?
You have given a very interesting presentation, Mr. Warnicke, from the point of view of overall strategy and negotiation. From that point of view, I'm wondering what the impact of budget situation is when you really begin to cut. Right now, as I understand it, our Secretary of Defense and the Congress are having considerable argument over which weapon systems to scrap or delay. I suspect that similar kinds of arguments go on in the Kremlin, or wherever their joint chiefs operate. And I wonder whether there is a backfire in operation here, in other words, which impacts on the actual negotiation process.
I think it does, to some extent. I think certainly the fact that we do have budgetary difficulties is one of the reasons for the waning enthusiasm for strategic defense. Now, some of the tests that had been scheduled have been called off, even in advance of any sort of an agreement. And I think that's because the Joint Chiefs figure that if you spend $200-300 billion for the attempted development of a strategic defense in space, that you're not going to be able to get the nice ships and airplanes and the rest of the stuff that admirals and generals ride with pride.
Other questions? Henry Theobar.
Assuming that there is a balance, de facto balance between the two major powers, could one make the case that a 10% increase or a 10% decrease is a budgetary rather than a disarmament matter? What's the difference from a military standpoint if you have, if you go from a balance and each goes 10% higher, isn't that really a monetary, budgetary factor rather than a military factor?
It depends on what you spend the money for. I mean, there are certain weapon systems that from the arms control standpoint are bad. The classic example, of course, is the MIRV missile. Now, if we hadn't MIRV'd our missiles back in the early 1970s, we would have been able to make much greater progress in arms control, and we'd have far less fear than we have had about a first strike. So it depends on what you can spend that 10% on. Now, one of the things, of course, that we're going to spend quite a bit of money on, if we go ahead with it, is the Midget Man missile. But if you have agreed upon ceilings, and you use up, and the Soviet Union uses up a lot of its warheads on single warhead mobilized ICBMs, then that's very expensive, but it's also very good from the standpoint of stability. Now, one of the real problems that I think the Pentagon is faced with now is what to do about the B-2 stealth bomber. Again, from the arms control standpoint, no problems. Stabilizing system, not a first strike system, strictly retaliatory, but tremendously expensive. And not only that, but our start position, as I mentioned, has been one which really contemplates having a substantial number of warheads on strategic bombers. Now, even the B-52 is eventually going to wear out. And the B-1 has not turned out to be a technological marvel. So that there is a good case for the B-2, but at $500 million each, it's too expensive to fly. I think it's basically a risk to the pilot, because who's going to bail out with a $500 million aircraft, no matter what kind of shape it's in?
Bill Griswold.
When World War II ended, I was personally afraid we'd go back to things as they were in the 30s. But the Russians getting over the traces and all that stuff, Korean War, and being a merchant of death in Sperry, I was employed until the time I retired.
Mm-hmm.
What concerns me now is, what do we do? How can we cut back this tiger by the tail that we've got? $300 billion a year, you can't push it into bridges or interurban railroads, and you can't employ engineers to design this stuff to build bridges. How do we get off this tiger?
I think it's going to be hard, but our economy really is not dependent upon the defense budget. No, to a far lesser extent, really, than a lot of the European economies. And I think that we do have a number of unmet needs that will, in fact, sop up some part of that cash. The fact is that military expenditures, by and large, are not tremendously labor-intensive. That's particularly true when it comes to nuclear weapons. It's one of the reasons why the AFL-CIO has been very supportive of arms control. They aren't really talking about very substantial reductions in jobs. Now, conventional arms control is going to be a greater problem from that standpoint, because there's much more of a labor force involved. It is a problem. It's one that we're going to have to try and handle. It's a problem I'd like to have.
Well, we presently have it at Grumman.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's why they're taking full page ads on the F-14.
Dorothy, for Danny Griswold.
We've all known for some time about the phased array radar at Krasnoyarsk. This morning in the Wall Street Journal, there's an article which you may have seen saying that there are about 14 more of these radars around the Soviet Union, but that the others fall just within the parameters of the ABM treaty. How do you deal with that?
It really is not much of a problem. See, the fact is that the Krasnoyarsk radar is a violation of the ABM treaty, but it's a violation not because it's an ABM radar. It's because it's a phased array early warning radar in the wrong location. Now, we and the Soviet Union both have early warning radars all around the periphery of the nation. We have many, many ourselves. And the real issue is, could that be speedily converted into some sort of a battle control radar that would have an ABM capability? And I think the way you handle that is by on-site inspection. Just verify the fact that they could not make a rapid breakout that would turn it into a battle management radar.
Other question? Yes, Colonel Foote.
We've had these
exchanges of these very high-level fellers, Admiral Crow and the Soviet defense minister and the chiefs of staff and Dalai the president of Congress, would you comment on to what extent you think these exchanges and the apparently very broad display on both sides of what we've got and what we haven't. In the movies the other day, you saw Admiral Crow seeing a Kiev missile cruiser firing missiles and getting in the latest Soviet fighter and seeing ground attack demonstration. Apparently, we did a pretty liberal show up over here, too, with the Soviet side.
I think it's a very good development. It's something we tried to do in the Carter administration. Harold Brown and my great and good friend, whose name I now forget, who was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Davy Jones, tried very hard to do exactly what Bill Crow has now been able to do with Akhramayev and Akhramayev's successor. And their feeling was that the more they knew about what the other side was capable of doing, the safer we were all going to be. I think good intelligence is very good for us, and I welcome these exchanges.
Other questions? Dr. Aldrich?
Mr. Warnke, it's been reassuring to hear someone with your breadth of experience be as optimistic as you've been today. You did mention that no international organization at present, I think, would make a contribution to the arms control. I wonder if your optimism extends to the International Organization of the Future as a participant or as a contributor to arms control.
Yeah, it does. It seems to me that there's a lot that the international institutions could do that they have not been able to do because of the bitter hostility between the Soviet Union and the United States. I mean, you can't really expect the United Nations to play a significant peacekeeping role if both the United States and the Soviet Union are going in opposite directions. Now, one thing that I can say would be that if, in fact, we negotiated a comprehensive nuclear test ban and also a cutoff of the production of weapons-grade fissionable materials, you would then have to have a very greatly beefed up International Atomic Energy Agency. You'd have to increase their charter, you'd have to increase their finances, and they'd have to have the right to go and inspect any sort of suspicious facility. I think that could be done, but it does require a very continued easing of the tensions between East and West. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You've twice alluded to the consequences of our applying MIRV technology in the 70s, and I wonder if you could take a moment to perhaps speak from a negotiating standpoint the role research and then the application of whatever technological advances you come up through your research plays. Is it a strengthening role? Is it a weakening role?
Again, it really depends upon what weapon system eventuates from that research. I'm all in favor of research. And I think even if we negotiate a strict control on strategic defense, you would still have to have a robust research program. You couldn't afford not to find out what's out there beyond the present frontiers of science. And if you did find some kind of magic device that, you know, activates the atmosphere so nuclear missiles can't get through, or something of that sort, then you would want to make sure that you found it as soon as the other side found it. Because you would not want to be in a position in which they had a perfectly invulnerable defense, and we did not. In addition to that, I think you have to continue a research program so you understand what it is that they are doing. So I'm all for research.
But what about the next step of actually applying that technology?
It depends upon what the technology is going to accomplish. And there is no question in my mind that we would have been able to stop the MIRVing of ballistic missiles if we had been able to get the ABM treaty maybe 2 years before. See, what gave MIRV the impetus was the concern about strategic defense. We figured that if all we had was single warhead missiles, that the Soviet Union, even with the 1970s, 1960s technology, might have a defense that would eliminate our retaliatory deterrent. So that's what pushed MIRVs. But what you really ought to do is try and coordinate your negotiating program and your development program and make sure that they're not headed in opposite directions.
Mrs. Fernbach.
What percentage of our present nuclear arsenal do you think that we could fire at the Russians, even if they didn't retaliate, without making most of our own country uninhabitable?
Well, that, of course, depends upon phenomena that are incompletely understood. As you know, Carl Sagan and a number of other researchers came up with the idea of nuclear winter. Mm-hmm. And they concluded that if enough nuclear explosions took place, that it would so change the environment as to bring about a nuclear winter and perhaps massive starvation or perhaps the elimination of the human race. And nobody's quite sure. All I can recall is that back at the time that we were thinking about an SST, a supersonic transport, that there were some scientists that said, if you use too many supersonic planes, you're going to destroy the ozone layer. Now, nobody's quite sure. But a couple of hundred nuclear explosions is something that, frankly, I hope the world never has to live through or die through.
Thousands.
Yeah.
Is or should anybody be doing any kind of contingency planning in the event that we have another Afghanistan or something goes wrong in some other way, so far as continuation of arms control negotiation? If something goes wrong, is any arms agreement as dead as SALT II became, or are there ways that one can prepare for and anticipate things going wrong and continue our arms negotiation in the same way we continue our ambassadors serving abroad in crisis areas? Mm-hmm.
Well, as a point of pride, let me disagree with the fact that Salt was killed. I mean, the fact is that it expired by its terms 4 years ago, and both sides are still basically abiding by the sealants. The Soviet Union is destroying its existing older missiles as it puts the SS-24 and SS-25 in the field. So they've continued to abide by the sealants. I think that you can't really totally separate other events from arms control. I'm against linkage. It seems to me that either arms control is good for us or bad for us. And if it's good for us, we ought to pursue it. But at the same time, there are certain events that take place that you just can't ignore. Now, you shouldn't let the day-by-day ins and outs of the U.S.-Soviet relationship interfere with the negotiations. And I don't think we have. But I can recall back in the summer of 1968, and the very day on which the SALT talks were to be announced, both in Moscow and Washington, was the day the Soviet Union moved into Czechoslovakia. The Declaration of Independence speaks of a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. And it just proved, I think, politically impossible to announce the SALT talks at the time that this happened. And certainly there's no question that the invasion of Afghanistan killed any chance of ratification of SALT II. And the president was wise not to push it at that point. He would have lost. But there are some events like that, as I say, that are just of sufficient... They're sufficiently egregious so that you can't just apply logic. Emotion sets in.
Could you say a little bit about the negotiating process? Apparently, people have had interpret Mr. Carter's statement, the public does, in one way when he was asked who his foreign policy advisors were, and he said Paul Nitze and Paul Warnke. And the assumption has been that he was appealing to the public on the grounds that here are two people with different points of view. On the other hand, Nitze is going to be here on October 23rd, and you both have had some measure of success in negotiating. What could one ever prepare a handbook for arms control negotiators? Is there something you learn in this area that can be passed on? Are there principles? Uh, what what can one say about the whole process that that those of us who are laymen ought to understand a little better?
It's very hard to generalize. I think that it does help if you've had considerable negotiating experience in other fields, just because there are certain tricks that are applicable no matter whether it's a labor negotiation or a negotiation for a contract between two private companies or a agreement between two independent nations. The big difference is that you have to recognize that you can't win in the sense that the other side loses. And I think that that's one thing that an arms control negotiator has to recognize. Either the deal is going to be good for both sides or it's going to be good for nothing. Because any arms control treaty will always have an escape clause, which says that if your supreme interests have been jeopardized, you're entitled to repudiate the treaty. And even if you didn't have that escape clause, if you found that you had been out-traded to your security detriment, you'd never abide by the deal. So you have to be sure that both sides are going to be satisfied with the ultimate result. Now, that doesn't mean that both sides have to make the same concessions or even equivalent concessions. Certainly in the CAFE talks, the Soviet Union will have to make many, many times the number of cuts that we make. But the question is their security going to be jeopardized? And the answer is no. You know, if they were down to 50% of the present NATO forces, they would be no less secure than they are today. But with regard to the START talks, it is totally infeasible to expect the Soviet Union to cut their ballistic missile warheads in half and take a chance that our strategic defense plans are going to be technological turkeys, because they would feel that their security was jeopardized. So that's what I mean. You've got to look at it from both sides. And that's the difference between that and a commercial negotiation. There's no court you can take an arms control treaty to and say, I demand specific enforcement. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Well, this, you, yes, yeah. Mr. Labus.
I'd like to know why in the past we had to think about so many nuclear weapons that would provide an overkill on both sides. Economically, it doesn't make sense, and now we have to back up.
That's right. I guess the answer is that nobody was quite sure when they started making nuclear weapons what the mission of the nuclear weapon was. Remember that back in the Eisenhower administration, his first Secretary of Defense, Charles Wilson, talked about more bang for a buck. And the idea was at that point you could cut way, way back on your conventional forces and depend upon your nuclear forces instead. Now that turned out not to be feasible. Didn't do us any good in Korea, didn't do us any good in Vietnam. But nobody was quite sure what the purpose was. And the other thing is that after all, deterrence is a question of perception. Now it's not enough to have enough. You have to have enough so that everybody knows you have enough. And nobody's quite sure what the answer is to that. You can make a good case, but rather than 12,000 nuclear weapons, if we had something like 400 clearly survivable nuclear weapons, that is enough of a deterrent. But if the Soviet Union had 12,000 and we had 400, would you be comfortable? Would our allies be comfortable? Now, would we be sure that the Soviet Union knew we had enough? So as they say, it's not an exact science.
Counting bombs is a strange kind of a thing.
It is.
Any other questions? Mr. Miller, who founded this place, had the idea that if you sat around the table with a person of great experience in a given area of public policy, that somehow the subject would be illuminated in a way that even the mass media and the mass press doesn't quite enable one the subject to be illuminated. I think to listen to a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and the Chief Arms Control Negotiator close up this way with very specific, hard, tough issues being put forward both in statements and in questions is the best way, I think, to come to know both the subject and the real Paul Warnke. So that's why we wanted him to come, and I think he and we have been right in getting together.
Thank you very much.